Spirit Blade Underground Episode 341. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground Episode 341.
Hello, welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out SpiritBlade.net. But on the show today, my first five review of Dragon Age Inquisition for PlayStation 4, and a look at letting Jesus out of the box as we continue our study of the book of Hebrews. Here we go. Nice. Another achievement unlocked. I bet I got more achievements than anybody I know.
Yes, sitting in front of a video game for 5 hours a day is quite an achievement.
See, this is why I don't like talking to you.
Then why don't you spend more time with real people?
Because real people don't respond to console commands.
Wow, Peter. You unlocked yet another achievement. You must have more achievements than anyone you know. Behold, you are great, and greatly to be praised.
Yeah, better. Kim Wiki wrote recently and said, have you seen this trailer for the new Dragon Age game, Inquisition? And then she gave me a link to the trailer. She said, it's been the ad in front of numerous web videos I've seen lately, and it seems to be implying that this game will have certain views concerning religious belief. Just curious as to whether you had any comments or plan to talk about the game or the hype for it on the podcast. Yes, absolutely. I'll be talking about the game and taking part in the hype to some degree, I suppose, because I've really been looking forward to Dragon Age Inquisition. I'm a big fan of the Dragon Age series. Well, I should say Dragon Age Origins and Dragon Age Awakening. Dragon Age Origins Awakening, I should say. That was the really full-length expansion. I kind of think of it as Dragon Age 2, as a sort of sequel, because it was like an expansion that was the length of really kind of like a short RPG, but I would certainly still call it a full-length experience, not just like DLC. I mean, that was like a full-on expansion, and it was great. And then Dragon Age 2, I think, took a big step in the wrong direction. It simplified the combat to the point of button mashing, literally. I mean, before the update was installed for Dragon Age 2, I had to hammer on the A button in order to just keep doing a basic attack over and over again, which didn't free up my right thumb to use the right stick to move the camera around and kind of appreciate the combat and stuff. I certainly didn't need to move the camera to do anything tactical because they gave you virtually no tactical options. You could only control your character, and like the inventory management was almost nil. I mean, man, it was, in my view, in many ways, barely a role-playing game. Certainly not turn-based remotely, certainly not real-time with pause, which was where the game finds its roots. It's a gameplay mechanic roots in the Baldur's Gate series and Neverwinter Nights and things like that. Yeah, it was just a big departure. And then the dungeons and stuff were like, oh, so basic and used over and over again. You know, they use the same maps for dungeons over again, but would just start you out in a different place. And oh my gosh. And then the most of the game took place in just this big city, and that's it. You know, whereas the first game had to deal with the entire realm, the entire land you had to save, you know. So it was just major steps back. It felt like a really rushed product. Really sad, really sad. So, but I've, you know, heard lots of things that they were, you know, really working to kind of win back the trust of fans. And because, you know, up to this point, I've been kind of like a BioWare can almost do no wrong kind of guy, you know, with the exception of the ending to Mass Effect 3, which, you know, was all right, but it certainly didn't factor in all these various, you know, choices that you could make throughout the entire thing, you know, even with the updated ending, which kind of did give you a little bit of a little bit more, I guess, resolution of the plot. You know, it was just not satisfying, you know. And what I felt after the Mass Effect games was that really BioWare, they're trying to make this big deal out of choice and being able to, you know, be the Paragon or the Rogue or whatever, you know. And they're trying to kind of simulate choice, but they've really just created this kind of uncanny valley where choice, it's not what they're giving you is a limited number of bad options to choose from. And they're trying to simulate the feeling of, oh man, you know, life has a lot of hard choices and stuff like that. And you know, it's not always clear what the right decision is and stuff like that. Well, when I'm playing their games, in my mind, a lot of the time I'm like, okay, I am very clear on what I think the right decision would be here, but it's not one of the three options you're giving me to choose from. So I have to choose. Well, the only thing that makes your option hard to choose is that I think they stink. You know, it's not because the moral element, you know, is kind of gray and kind of complex and stuff like that. I mean, oftentimes that is the case, but plenty of other times it's like, no, it's really clear to me, you know, how I would respond here or where I would take the conversation at this point to clarify the issue, and you're not letting me do that, you know. So anyway, and you know, it's I don't know what I don't think the technology will allow for moving in that direction to really give me the freedom of choice that I want. But, you know, at this point, it just kind of feels like they're teasing that kind of level of choice. And I'd rather have an experience more along the lines of Skyrim, where your choices are expressed in your actions. And in that regard, you can absolutely do whatever you want. You know, you might not have all the limited, you might not have unlimited dialogue choices, but your action choices and how you affect the plot with your actions is very, very wide open. And I usually don't find that to be the case in the BioWare games, beginning with Dragon Age and Mass Effect. But anyway, nevertheless, I've been very excited about Dragon Age Inquisition, and I bought it the day it came out. I got the deluxe edition for PlayStation 4, which includes some extra DLC and stuff that I actually haven't even encountered yet. But I have now played over 5 hours of this game, and so I am ready to present you with my first five review, where I give you my first five impressions of the first 5 hours of a game. So the five impressions that I had watching this game include the visuals, the sound, the gameplay, the story, and lastly, relevance. Or I would explain that by saying, you know, themes of moral relevance or spiritual relevance or something along those lines. So first, let me talk about the visuals. Really, it has some beautiful landscapes, both nearby landscapes and distant landscapes. I would say that the fidelity is increased from playing like the Dragon Age games on 360, or really just 360 games in general. But apart from that, I don't think we're seeing at this point what these new consoles can potentially do. Like, for example, there's one point where I'm walking in this cave and there's some ice there, and the ice at one point on the wall is flat and smooth, and it clearly looks like it should be a reflective surface. In fact, it's reflecting other things that are in the cave. I'm seeing those in the ice. But when I walk up to it, I do not see my character's reflection in the ice, and my character is not a vampire, so I kind of want to see that reflection, given that they're reflecting all these other elements in the ice. So fidelity is increased, but I think some of those more like game engine type stuff that would take a little bit more processing power, or maybe I should say take advantage of the increased processing power. Because I mean, I'm not a tech guy, but I kind of assume that these new consoles, you know, ought to be able to handle that kind of processing, those kinds of incidental images. And effects. So the lighting looks really great, though. I'd say the lighting effects are really nice, but it would have been nice to see some of those other finer details. Still, though, beautiful game. Beautiful game. And, you know, if you got to choose, if you're going to be getting a next-gen console anyway, then I would say get this on a next-gen console. You know, I mean, there's no reason not to, unless, you know, it's not in your budget to buy the console at this point. This, in my mind, this game, before I go on to my other thoughts on it, is not like a system seller in the sense that a lot of people mean that. phrase, but it was for me because I knew I was going to get a PS4. And since I was going to get a PS4 and since I had the money set aside for it, you know, I might as well get it in anticipation of getting Dragon Age. It's kind of my first PS4 game, you know. And so I ended up getting my PS4 a little bit early because I had the money for it, and it was handy to have a second Blu-ray player in the house. But, you know, all I've been playing on it really is Rezogun, you know, up until this point. So Dragon Age is really the game that the first game that I really bought my PS4 in anticipation of playing. So so if you're in that camp, you know, I would say probably, you know, if you've got the money, go ahead and get your next-gen console and get into Dragon Age Inquisition on PS4, because it does look very nice. It's also got, you know, a serious art design, which I appreciate. You know, I tend to lean towards stuff that's not cartoony when it comes to my fantasy RPGs. I like something that's, you know, kind of gritty and not necessarily dark, but just kind of like, it's got some grit in it, you know. It's a dirty world. People are dirty and things get scuffed up, and you know, it's not all nice and clean and pretty. Although I do gotta say that this, by comparison to Skyrim's visual design, just in terms of what people look like, what clothes look like, and stuff, this is kind of like the WB version of Skyrim, you know? Or if you watch a WB show, I was just watching Flash on Hulu the other day, and I was just kind of reminded again that when you watch a WB show, everybody's beautiful. There are all these beautiful people. There aren't really any normal-looking people, you know? They just cast a bunch of models who pose, you know? And, you know, they'll put scars on the characters and stuff, but the scars, they somehow just seem to draw attention to their attractive features, you know? I mean, that's a little exaggeration, but compared to Skyrim, it is a bit of a WB type of look to it. But that said, it's still, you know, they're still going for a serious look. It's not like cartoony, like, say, what I've seen of World of Warcraft or Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, where it is more of this kind of animated type of cleaner look. No, this is definitely more of a, you know, a gritty kind of world, but it's stylish gritty. The spell animations look really cool. Yeah, I won't say more about that. I mean, I just kind of expect that in RPGs, but they've certainly continued with that trend. It looks very nice here. And I would say that they are more interesting than, say, like the spell animations in Skyrim, you know, which just kind of like, you know, they do the spell. These have a little bit more flair to them. Like, you shoot off magic, and before it hits your guy, they kind of swirl around in the air a little bit and then hit your guy. Kind of like they're, you know, heat-seeking, you know, bolts of magic, you know? So, you know, it's nice. I do get to say, though, the facial and body animations, they're still very much last generation. That's another area that I really would love to see some forward motion in. But, you know, can I really fault them for it? No, because right now, most people are playing video games, even, you know, most hardcore gamers, I would guess, are still playing on 360 and PS3. They haven't moved on to PS4, and I don't blame them, you know? And so they're having to design these games, I think, probably with those kinds of consoles in mind, and you know, they probably can't do as extensive of motion tracking or motion capture. I don't know anything about the technology, but I'm willing to cut them some breaks here when it comes to that kind of stuff, because this is a multi-platform game. And there's also some, this I'm not real happy about, but it's not that big a deal. There's some minor infrequent texture pop-in on the PS4 version I've noticed so far. It's not glaring like in the first Mass Effect game, where you would like see it all the time, everywhere, happening all the time. It's just like, oh, was that just a little pop in of texture? Did that just suddenly get a little bit sharper? And it usually just happens when you first come upon something, or when a scene goes from a black screen to, you know, first coming in, and then it's gone. It's certainly infrequent. So it's, you know, it's just kind of like a little observation that, oh, okay, well, they didn't quite optimize this maybe as much as they could have. But again, you know, multi-platform, I'm not sure what I can expect there. Moving on to sound now. As always with a BioWare game, top-notch voice acting. I almost didn't even talk about this because I just kind of take it for granted that BioWare's games are going to have great voice acting. I think the Skyrim just kind of caught up with this in their in the Elder Scrolls V Skyrim. But I'm not even sure that I would say that Skyrim's voice acting was on par with the voice acting in Dragon Age Inquisition. I mean, it's just really solid stuff. These guys are blazing a trail and leading the way when it comes to voice acting in RPGs, I think. What I would say, though, is that I would like more character voice options for, like, my guy. As far as I could tell, you only have two male voice options and two female voice options, which is a bit of a bummer, because when you would look at, Neverwinter Nights, you had, like, I don't know, four or five different voice types, sometimes two voice types for each type of character, like, you know, an evil wizard and a kind wizard and, you know, stuff like that. And I really would have loved to have a wider range of voice options. I would love to, you know, I'm playing like this wizard and I kind of want him to be this kind of crusty, somewhat crusty older guy. And because of the WB character creation options, I couldn't make him look as old and crusty as I wanted him to. I did the best I could, you know. But I'd like this
voice that's old and decrepit and very scary,
you know, or something like that, you know. And they don't really give me that option, but I could have gotten something more like that, say, playing one of the Infinity Engine games or playing Neverwinter Nights or something like that. Now, granted, in those earlier games, they didn't have near as much voice interaction in terms of, like, the cutscenes. It was mostly reading text. So, you know, to do what I'm describing, you'd have to get, like, 5 to 12, you know, solid voice actors, maybe less if they can do different voices, you know, but, you know, at least close to a handful of voice actors just to voice the main female and male versions of your character. And to do all that dialogue in, like, 5 different voices, you know, that's going to cost more money. It's going to take more time. And yeah, you know, but still, you know, if we can move everything else forward, oh, it'd be awesome if we could move that forward too, you know, and really get more of a customized character experience. Would have been nice. But as it is, that's somewhat of a minor complaint. The sound design is really great. You know, you hear the crunchy boots on the snow and all that stuff that you've come to expect that should be there, you know, that I'm almost tempted not to comment on because it just should be there now. But I should say it is there and it is great. Along with the music, also, it's not mind-blowing, but it is great. It's great sweeping fantasy music, creepy when it needs to be, exciting when it needs to be, you know, so the sound is really working on this game. All right, now let's move on to number 3 impression, and that's gameplay. So the combat specifically, you press or hold R2 on your controller on the PS4 to attack, and to just attack once, or hold on to it and you'll keep attacking, very much in that regard like Dragon Age 2, the default combat. But what's nice about that is you're using the right trigger, so you can still have complete use of your thumb to control the camera with the right stick. Now the tactical mode, I'm still getting used to the interface on that. Dragon Age Origins was much more intuitive, I think, but it didn't have as good of camera options. I guess that would be the main difference. I might end up playing with the AI options more than the tactical mode. And what I mean by that is, if you've played Final Fantasy XII or Dragon Age Origins, you can go into these menu screens where you set up AI options. You say, okay, this character in my party, whenever he gets to this percentage of health, then he'll use a potion. And you can adjust that percentage, you know? And in Final Fantasy XII, it was even more extensive than in Dragon Age Origins, because you could, like, set up individual spells where you would say, you know, okay, when this happens, I'm going to cast this spell and I'm going to cast it on this person. You know, I mean, you could really play with the AI, and something like that would have been really cool in this game. But I mean, you know, that's probably asking quite a bit. But anyway, I do appreciate the AI settings that they do allow for in this game, which basically, you know, allow you to set up, like, how frequently characters will use special abilities in combat, as opposed to just doing their normal attack. And I think the options are, like, they'll never use them, they'll use them a lot, or they'll only use them when appropriate, you know. And so those are pretty good options. And then, as I said, apart from that, you do have some AI options for each character, and you can set up, you know, which ability they'll use in those modes, like you know, all the time or never or when appropriate. You know, you can set that up for your individual mapped abilities, spells and powers and stuff like that. And then apart from that, on on each character, you have the option to trigger when they're going to use health potions, or you know, or how many health potions you want to keep in reserve, so that you know not all your health potions get swallowed away by the AI healing themselves and each other and stuff like that. So there are still some nice basic tactical AI options that I do appreciate. I'm a little bit between a rock and a hard place in the combat, because I feel like the action combat, when you're not using any of the tactical interface, is a little bit too simple for my taste. You know, just holding down the R button and then occasionally hitting, you know, other abilities, you know, that you might have. I mean, it's all right. But I do like something that's a little bit more tactical now and then. And the tactics mode right at this point, I like it. I like the information that's accessible via the tactics mode, because you can kind of see enemies and how many hit points they have left and what they're immune to. And you can learn more about them in that tactics mode, which is really helpful and cool. But it's the camera that I'm still trying to work out how to see what I want to see and kind of manipulate and move around visually the tactical mode environment. That's me just adjusting to it. Nothing seems to be broken about it. I just need to figure out, okay, what do I need to do in order to get the information I want and to do what I want within this tactical mode? So the jury is still out, but I'm not pessimistic at all about the tactical mode. One thing I noticed when loading up the game is that it says contacting the EA, the Dragon Age servers. And so far it hasn't screwed with my ability to load a game save. But one thing I noticed and hated about Dragon Age Origins, and this happened recently when I wanted to try out Dragon Age Origins again, just for a little bit to kind of refresh my memory on how the game played. I tried to load it up and it couldn't even contact the Dragon Age servers. And since I was trying to load a save that had DLC in it that I had purchased and downloaded online, in order to load that game save, you've got to be able to access the Dragon Age servers so that they can confirm that you own it and you're the owner of it. You know, so the overlords at EA are just kind of keeping their tendrils in the stuff that you bought to make sure that you bought it fairly every time you load up the game. And if for some reason their servers aren't working in Dragon Age Origins, then you can't load a game save that uses DLC or something that you bought online, you know, as opposed to just whatever came on that basic disc when you bought the game. That is so freaking frustrating. And, you know, so there's now three ways that you could potentially not load your save. The Dragon Age servers could be down. The Xbox Live server could have some problems, or your own internet connection could be, you know, not working great or something wrong with it, you know. And all three of those things seem to happen for me from time to time, and that's really frustrating. So I haven't seen that happen yet with Dragon Age Inquisition, but the fact that every time I load up the game and to start it, it first checks in with the Dragon Age servers does not bode well to me. I'm very concerned about that. We'll see what happens. Again, jury out on that, but EA, geez Louise, why do you punish the people that bought your product fairly? Find another way to protect your content, or just, you know, shrug at your losses a bit. I'm not confident that that's worth it to pester your customers, you know, this much. Yeah, because eventually in the long run, that'll make me just kind of give up on playing a game, you know, by EA. Maybe I've played the basic game and I'm happy with that, and then they come out with some DLC. Maybe I'll buy that DLC and I'll be like, oh, this is cool, and then I'll notice that I keep having problems for one reason or another loading up my game, so I'll move on and get interested in other games. And, oh, another DLC comes out for Dragon Age. Yeah, but remember how annoying it was with the last one? You know, I don't know. I'm kind of enjoying this game right now. Guys at EA, in the end, that can really bite you in the butt, and it certainly is not going to earn you any goodwill from your fans. Something that BioWare games could really use right now, I think. All right, so on from that. Again, that's not a problem I'm seeing. It's just there's just a potential foreshadow of something bad that could come about if they don't handle their digital content rights management in a customer-friendly way. The menu navigation in general is not super intuitive at first, but I am adjusting to it. So all that said, I'm feeling like this is solid gameplay. You know, it's not like, wow, this is some great, smooth, awesome, intuitive gameplay. I think I could find myself there, you know, after a few more days of playing the game a couple hours at a time, you know. But neither does it feel like, you know, broken or inhibitive or, you know, anything like that. You know, for example, last night when I was feeling a little bit tired, I ended playing the game earlier than I might normally if like it was really intuitive and working well for me, because I was like, I'm a little too tired to wrestle my brain through figuring out these, you know, this whatever it is that I'm working on at the moment. So anyway, it's not fantastic in that department, but it's still good and solid. All right, moving on to the story now, number four impression. And that's, I don't have a whole lot to say here. It's, the story is fine, but I'm barely into it at this point. It doesn't start out doing anything new. I am interested in where it's going to go, especially given, you know, kind of the themes, which I'll get to in a second. But I mean, this game is called Dragon Age Inquisition. And you basically find yourself in the middle of a civil war from the get-go, before the first, you know, major thing even starts. There's a war going on between the Templars, which are agents of the big church religious organization, and the mages, you know, who the church has been kind of concerned, you know, can go nuts and crazy, and so they've kind of kept them on a leash for years and years and years. Well, that whole situation just kind of blew up as of the events of Dragon Age 2, and now there's an all-out war between Templars and mages that you're kind of in the middle of. So I'm really interested to see how that's going to play out, especially given that I am playing a mage. I'm very interested to see where the story's going to go. Right now, though, it was notable to me that it doesn't start out doing anything new right away. And it would have been cool if they would have started out with just like punching me in the gut with something really intense. You know, like, again, I'm going to compare it to Skyrim. If you haven't played The Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, the first hour of that game, or the first 30 minutes of that game, when you're heading off to your execution and then all hell breaks loose, that is like the best opening to a game I've ever experienced in my life. That was an awesome opening. And I would have loved something like that here to really kick things off to a crazy, awesome start. But I didn't see that, and that was notable to me. I wish that they would have done something more there. Still, it's BioWare, and generally they, you know, have some interesting things going on. And so I'm interested to see where it'll go. All right, and finally, number five, and that's relevance. You know, is there anything of moral significance or philosophical or spiritual significance or, you know, that's going on here? Absolutely, absolutely. Now, there's no sign of a homosexual agenda yet, which is something that's been increasing in BioWare's last several games, although there is an openly gay character coming, and he's been advertised. This was part of their marketing team, you know, was like making a big deal out of this, you know, that at one point, this was a while back, but, you know, talking about how there's an openly gay character, and this is not a bisexual character that will just, because there are some characters in the Dragon Age games that, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, you can flirt with them and they will respond, you know, and so that kind of makes them bisexual, I guess. But this character is specifically gay and will only respond to male advances. He will not respond and kind of readjust his sexuality to female responses. He is only going to be a gay character. And that's going to be coming, joining my party at some point. I don't know when. I just know that's coming at some point. So I'll be very interested to see what kind of options they give me to interact with that character. I was very frustrated with my inability to interact with Zevran, the bisexual character of Dragon Age. I believe it was Dragon Age. I can't remember if it was Origins now or Dragon Age 2. There was a gay character in Dragon Age 2 that, anyway, I've been very unhappy with the options they've given me to interact with homosexual characters in the past. It seems like the only options I get are to either completely, you know, validate their, you know, their sexuality and the choices they're making in their pursuit of, you know, their sexual desires. So that's one option. Or the other option is to, like, completely be disgusted by them, you know? There didn't seem to be an option to validate their worth as a being, and to just love on them and care about them, without either flirting with them or validating, you know, something that I don't want to validate, you know? So anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that happens. At this point, I haven't run into that, so I can't really comment on that. But I do plan on, if I feel like there's something worth reacting to or commenting to, doing some talking about that maybe on the podcast or making a video maybe about it in the future. So stay tuned for my thoughts on that, if any. The anti-organized religion themes, though, are still very strong right from the get-go. And yeah, you know, we should really, I think, expect that with a subtitle Inquisition, which that word alone has a ton of historical baggage in the real world to it. So I think they're intentionally bringing that to this game. In this game, you know, basically the church is evil. You know, what we know about the Messiah is wrong, or at least suspect. The truth can't really be known. But people become more and, you know, about their Messiah, but people become more and more arrogant and judgmental and convinced that they, you know the truth. The further up you go in church leadership, with their kind of Pope stand-ins, even viewing themselves as perfect and even divine in nature, you know? So I found that stuff very interesting. It makes me wonder, okay, what are they commenting on here? You know, are they just kind of haphazardly taking their perceptions of Christianity or Catholicism and just kind of exaggerating those? Or are those their impressions of, you know, traditional brands or very organized, structured, traditional brands of Christianity, you know? I'd be very curious, you know? There are indications in the church history records in this world that the church, while giving lip service to their Messiah, who's called Andraste, it's a female, but it's very clear that they're riffing on the life and history of Jesus in this character, Andraste. The indications in the church historical records in this world that although they give lip service to their Messiah as the focus of their adoration, the church actually prioritizes themselves, their own organization, over their professed object of worship. And so that was an interesting little kind of note to see that, you know, I think there's some potential truth to that, especially in tradition-focused Christianity. Some of the older traditions that really have lots of kind of rituals and stuff like that, that, you know, at the right traditional church that really values truth, then the truth is brought out of those and explained. You know, all those rituals are explained and the truth is brought out of them, and it can be very rich, rich experiences. But, you know, the majority of traditional churches that I've visited or been to or whatever, there's no effort to do that. And it just kind of, everyone seems to kind of be going through the, you know, the motions, and yet people will be really, have really strong opinions about things like musical style and just kind of the trappings, the stuff that at the end of the day doesn't really matter. And they hold that above the things that really do matter, you know? So, you know, I think that whether that's an intentional commentary on that sort of thing or not, I think that's potentially valid and something that we should watch out for as believers, you know? Am I prioritizing the right things? Is this really about Jesus in the end? And if so, how is this tradition or this ritual or this thing that we're doing, how does it point to truth? You know, am I engaging in the truth in this moment? Or is this just something that for whatever reason gives me comfort, makes me feel good or whatever, but it's not really, you know, I'm not really thinking and engaging and relating to Jesus through this thing that I'm doing, you know? So, yeah, so I think there's some room for self-reflection on that kind of stuff, you know, in that regard. Now, I had to dig for these bits, but as I see in these games, and I'm already seeing in this game, those bits that you can read in those documents that a lot of gamers are not even going to bother looking through, that all is played out and represented significantly in the representatives of the chantry or the church in this game. So I'm already seeing that in the way that, you know, the characters are portrayed and the way that the church leaders talk to me and my party and stuff like that. So I think even though I had to dig for this stuff, it's still, you know, it's still relevant. It's still there even in the dialogue. It's just not quite as clear the, you know, why they would be this way and why they would feel this way and what the views are. So if you want to get into kind of the theology of the you'll see the, I guess I would say the ramifications of their theology played out in the church leaders that you interact with in Dragon Age Inquisition. But if you want to know, you know, the original theology itself, you're going to have to stand around town and listen to one of the chanters outside of a church building kind of chanting a song about that describes their theology, or you're going to have to go digging through some books. But you will definitely see the ramifications of their theology played out in who they are as people. Anyway, that's all I've got to say about Dragon Age Inquisition. You know, I suppose I am being a little bit nitpicky on some things, despite the fact that I really see a lot of promise in this game and really have been enjoying it. It's not blowing me away, but I mean, it's doing all the things that I love about RPGs that I expect them to do. And so for that reason, I give it a quality score right now of 8.5 out of 10. And for all the very more and more surface level themes that I see going on, I give it a relevant score of 8.5 out of 10. I would not be a bit surprised if over the course of this game, that relevant score, I would adjust that to climb up to a 9.5 by the end, maybe even 10. I'll be very interested to see, because it just seems like, you know, if that was a strong theme and part of the world in previous games, it is coming to the center in this game. So I wouldn't be surprised if by the end we have a 10 out of 10 type of relevant situation going on here. All right, well, that's it. I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
In this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language that we take for granted, using a little cultural history and linguistics now and then as I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and then apply some of what God has for us in these words today. We're continuing our look today at the book of Hebrews. We're in chapter 8, and this time looking at verses 4 through 13. I'll read that from the ESV. It says, "Now if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all." The author's talking about Jesus here. "Since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law, they serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, 'See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain.' But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, 'Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. With the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, the author of Hebrews says, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. All right, well, the author of Hebrews is now describing how Jesus is not only a superior and ultimate mediator, priest, between us and Yahweh God, but he serves as our go-between within a far better system of mediation. In previous verses, we saw that a temple, a special place that acts as a connecting point between us and God, is still a good thing, still a needed thing. And it was implied in verse 2 that Jesus serves us in a better temple than the one that had been built on earth for worship of Yahweh. Looking at verse 4, the reason that Jesus is not serving as a priest in the earthly temple is because that temple was set up for use by priests under the old system of law, who were only eligible as priests if they fit certain criteria, such as being born from the tribe of Levi. Now, under that system, Jesus wouldn't even be eligible to serve as a priest, since he was born from the tribe of Judah. Jesus also offered a sacrifice completely different from those required by the old law. And we see that in Hebrews chapter 7, verse 27. In pointing this out, the author of Hebrews is making it clear that Jesus isn't like, he's not competing with the Levitical priests for the honor of, you know, greatest priest among priests. He is making the earthly priests, the old priests, obsolete. He's replacing them. And now looking at verse 5, the old system of priests operated within a building that, as ornate and beautifully artistic as it was, it only acted as a symbolic replica of the true tabernacle, the true tent of Yahweh. The author of Hebrews calls the temple a copy and a shadow of the real thing. As the author points out, Yahweh had a very particular idea in mind regarding how the earthly tabernacle should be built. The reason for that is revealed here because it was meant to refer to the better tabernacle that would replace it. All right, now verses 6 through 7, Jesus serves us much more effectively than the old priests did, because his service, uniting us with God, is based on a better agreement, or the Bible would say covenant, a better agreement between God and humanity. The old agreement for how relations would work between God and humanity was conditional. We had to be willing and able to hold up our end of the agreement, or the whole system would fall apart. And we see that in Deuteronomy 28:15 and the context there, 28:36 and 28:64, because they weren't going to be able to hold up their end of the agreement, God said, listen, if you do this, then this is all going to fall apart. You're going to end up in another land and you're going to worship other gods there. And I'm just going to let that happen, you know. But this new agreement doesn't have any of the weakness of the old one, which is made more obvious when we compare the two. All right, so looking at verses 8 through 13 now, the author says that God himself acknowledges shortcoming in the first agreement, the first covenant, and then quotes Jeremiah 31:31-34 to prove his point. So here, 600 years before Jesus was born, Yahweh tells the world in advance that he's going to be bringing about a new covenant that's better than the old one. In the old one, Israel failed to hold up their end, so Yahweh was not obligated to carry out his end either. We see that in verse 9. But under this new agreement, this new covenant, the law of God will be internalized in the hearts and minds of his people, and the relationship between humanity and God will be restored. And we see that in verse 10. Now, it's as a little side note here, it's worth noting that although this agreement, this covenant with Israel, although this agreement is with Israel, non-Jews, probably you and I, unless you're a Jew, non-Jews who place their trust in Christ are grafted in to the family of God. And this is hinted at in Genesis 12:3 and stated more clearly in Romans 11:11-27. So as we're looking in Hebrews about this new covenant with Israel, we shouldn't be thinking, okay, well, this doesn't apply to us. It absolutely does apply to us. Under this new covenant, there will also no longer be a need for teachers, because everyone will know God deeply, and they'll be constantly pursuing a deeper knowledge of and relationship with him. And I think we see that in verse 11. The wrath of God will be non-existent in this new covenant, and no sins will be held against anyone. All right, looking at verse 12 now. That's in verse 12. Sorry, I put a space in my notes here. I thought I was moving on to a thought about verse 12, but that thought is taken from verse 12. Sorry. So in looking at this covenant, it's clear that not all of this has happened completely yet, but the process has begun. Jesus launched this new covenant during his earthly ministry, and he says as much in Luke 22, verse 20. The Apostle Paul tells us that part of this covenant is in place now, in that God dwells within every believer, all of whom have become his temple. And we see that in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16. And although teachers are still needed, we see that affirmed in Romans 12:7, the process of having God's law written on our hearts and our minds has begun with the work of the Holy Spirit, God himself, living inside of all believers. And we see that in John 16, verses 13 through 15, and also Romans chapter 8, verses 1 through 7. We're also seeing a change in how we relate to God. Obedience now is no longer something we do to avoid God's wrath. Jesus has freed us from that whole hopeless endeavor. Now, obedience is something we do purely to express love, trust, and gratitude toward God and to enter into a more effective and purposeful way of living. And I think we see that in John 14, verses 23 and 24. And already there is, as Romans 8:1 says, now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. All of these things make it obvious that the old covenant is obsolete and ready to be replaced, as verse 13 tells us. Now, having said all that, it's still easy, really easy, to fall into a sort of old covenant way of thinking. The world kind of seems to be asking us, and we feel it, I think, even more as geeks, the world seems to be asking us to behave a certain way, to fit in every day. And so it's easy to assume that, you know, if we've been distant from God for a while, that, you know, we kind of have to shape up and fall in line with his program, you know, before presuming that he will listen to us or care about our problems or want to be with us. It's easy for me to think of my free time as me time, you know, not even bothering to invite Jesus to speak to me throughout the day or giving him the freedom to interrupt my geeking out for something he wants me to suddenly think or pray about. You know, it's easy for me to box him in as though his dwelling place is in my Bible or my study books or my church building instead of in my heart and in my mind throughout every moment. But Jesus has freed us and is calling us out of that old covenant, that compartmentalized way of living, you know, where we live and serve him out of, you know, moral obligation everything's just kind of compartmentalized, you know. No, he's calling us out of that. He wants us to dwell with him and recognize that he dwells with us always, every moment. He wants us to converse. He wants to converse with us and celebrate the fun we're having with us. You know, he wants us to recognize in the moments of our geeking out that he gifted someone with creativity in a way that he knew we in particular would enjoy. You know, I can almost imagine him saying, "That's for you. I knew you were going to love that." And he also wants us to be listening constantly, allowing him to suddenly interrupt our plans, our geeking out, to engage in an opportunity he has orchestrated for us to pray, to serve, or to invest in somebody else. Someday, the new covenant is going to be in full effect, but there's no reason not to begin experiencing that new covenant life today. Feedback, input, I want to hear from you guys. Request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, whatever. It all helps me make the show better. So just like Kim Wiki did, go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer, or as in her case, send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. All right, well, if you you know, want more information about Dragon Age Inquisition, or just some more of my thoughts, or you want to see some gameplay at the same time, I just put a video up for Dragon Age Inquisitions. It's called Dragon Age Inquisitions Trial and Error. That's where I play the first part of a game and kind of give you my thoughts as I stumble through. This trial and error is a little bit different than some of the other ones because I spent more time playing it and then I edited it down, as opposed to just bowling through, you know, 20 minutes of a game and seeing what happens. You know, I kind of cared about this game more than the average, you know, crazy shooter or sports game that I would do for trial and error. So, but anyway, that'll give you a little bit more idea of kind of like what the menus look like and feel like. And, you know, as I kind of worked my way through how to do the tactical combat stuff. So more stuff there if you are interested. Also, guys, I want to remind you, we're looking for CGC scanners. These are people who stay in touch with the latest geek news of their choice, of their interest, and then write a brief synopsis of it for Christian Geek Central just once a month. And we're open to all kinds of geek categories being covered, such as video games, movies, board games, paper and pencil RPGs, TV shows, comic books, novels. That's just naming a few. Whatever you're into, really. And it's a really easy role you can fill, since we will provide you with some newsletters that you can subscribe to. So, you know, you don't have to do your own searching through the internet month to month, you know, for info. The info will automatically come to you, and all you have to do is pick out some highlights and then type up a post with links on the Christian Geek Central website. And, you know, if writing isn't your strength, that's totally fine. Your post can be as simple as a list with links. You know, here's some, you know, some cool stuff going on in the world of blank this month, and then just list the links. You know, no fancy prose required. So as a CGC scanner, you're also welcome with each post to plug something you're doing or that you want to draw attention to. So take a second, think about the geeky stuff that you're into that, you know, you would enjoy keeping tabs on anyway, and then consider emailing Tim O'Donnell, the general administrator for Christian Geek Central. You can reach him at christiangeekcentral@gmail.com to become a CGC scanner. Again, that's Tim O'Donnell at christiangeekcentral@gmail.com. All right, guys, that's it for this week. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, I will share with you my review of a gamer movie that I saw a while back. I've been meaning to give you guys this review for a while. I'll be excited and happy to bring it next week, and that's the movie Unicorn City. Unicorn City. All right. Till then, thanks so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week, and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground. Take a group!
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Friends and with support from the Christian Geek Central community at christiangeekcentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit spiritblade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right, Farscape Season 2, Episode 209, Out of Their Minds.
Yes!
Yes! This is Farscape. This is why I love this show. If you haven't seen this one in a while, they run into these aliens that look a lot, admittedly, like the Skeksis from The Dark Crystal, but still look cool, you know. They get attacked by them, and something weird happens. Who cares, really, how it happened? The Star Trek fans can figure that one out. And it makes them switch bodies with each other. So you've got, like, Chiana inside Dargo's body, and you've got Dargo inside Pilot's body, and you've got Pilot inside Chiana's body, and you've got Rigel inside John's body, John inside Aaron, Aaron inside Rigel. I mean, it's all screwy. Love this episode. I mean, and this is probably the right time to do it. If they would have done this in season one, I don't think we would laugh as much, because we wouldn't be as familiar with these characters. They've given us time to get to know these characters so that we can recognize them being performed by another actor, you know. And I am so impressed with this cast. I mean, both in terms of their dramatic ability, but also in terms of their comedic ability and the subtlety with which they can do things. You know, you look at, I can't remember the name of the gal that plays Chiana. But you look at kind of her nuanced approach to Pilot's dialogue, and just like her inflection and the way her voice, the inflection moves up and down, is very specific, and it mimics what Lani Tupu does with Pilot so well. I mean, it's great. And then of course it's freaking hilarious to watch Anthony Simcoe be Chiana. I mean, before he even says that he's Chiana, you see what he's doing with his head and with his neck, and you're like, oh, crap, Chiana's inside Darko's body, you know? And it's just so easy to go along with the illusion that they're creating here because these are such fine actors. Now, I think there was a purpose behind... I'll get to that in a second. I will say that I think of this, of the body switching that goes on, possibly the weakest, at least among the actors, is Ben Browder's Rigel. Ben Browder strikes... He has great emotional access, you know, meaning that he can call up very real emotions, I think, while he's acting. That's how actors bring legitimate tears to their eyes and things like that. And so I think he has good emotional access, but I don't think Ben Browder is a really versatile, like, character type actor. And so that's maybe one of the reasons why his Rigel, I think his voice is good, but kind of his face seemed kind of wooden. He wasn't sure where to go. And I'm wondering if the reason for that is that he was trying to perform in his, in, you know, this actor's trying to perform in his human body what we see being done by a puppet. And puppets are naturally very limited in terms of their facial articulation and stuff like that, as beautiful and articulate as the Henson puppets are and as Rigel is, you know. How do you translate what Rigel is in terms of his facial performance? How do you translate that to an actor? You know, so I can't fault him too much, you know, for having a performance that seemed like it wasn't really committing to anything. Because what do you commit to when you're trying to move your face and your body in the way that Rigel does? You know, I mean, set aside for a moment the vast differences in their bodies. But anyway, all things considered, I think he did a fine job, you know, and just wonderful to see what all the other actors did. Now, what I was going to say before is I think there was probably some purpose in the writing room to having Zan off the ship when this happened. Because I think Virginia Hay is an example of someone who was cast because who they are fits the role. Not necessarily because they're a really phenomenal actor. I mean, she would tell you even in interviews that she's not a trained actor and she comes from a background of modeling. Yeah, she did Mad Max, and I think she's maybe done some other, few other small things. But I mean, she's not a trained or skilled actor in the same sense that the rest of the cast is by far. She just is a good fit for what they want out of the Zan character. Now, I don't like what they want out of the Zan character. I kind of hate the Zan character in most aspects, you know, but I do find her interesting from time to time. And but anyway, I think that they were probably specifically made sure that Virginia Hayes' character was not on the ship for two reasons, maybe, because would it really be all that funny and interesting for someone else to perform the Zan character? She's not funny. She's just going to bring down any kind of comedy that's going on, I think. And also because Virginia Hay probably is not very versatile, and I don't think she would be able to bring the kind of the nuance that these other actors do to their portrayal of these other characters. But, oh, man, I freaking love this episode. I love it so much. If you watch this episode and you've watched all the episodes from Farscape up to this point and you're like, I don't get it. This isn't really for me. I don't know how you got this far. I have no idea how you have muscled through Farscape if you watch Out of Their Minds and you don't like this episode. just stop now. You should have stopped a long time ago. Oh, man. Did you notice something interesting in the conversation with Pilot and Chiana Dargo in Pilot's body and Pilot in Chiana's body? They were talking about, you know, how they feel about each other while they're in their bodies and kind of the new memories that they are kind of getting access to. Now, this is really interesting because this implies, I think, as Farscape does. I don't think Farscape takes a naturalistic worldview where there is no spirituality. I think quite the reverse. You got a character like Zan, and you have clearly, you know, what seem to be clearly supernatural, we would say, characters like Maldus. And here, there's a reference to memories being left behind in the physical body. And one concept that's been suggested, I think it might have been, it was either in a William Lane Craig Defenders podcast. William Lane Craig is a popular thinker and apologist for the Christian faith. Or it was Norman Geisler's Systematic Theology at one point. Just talking about theories of the relationship between the non-physical and the physical parts of the human body, specifically the mind and the brain. And this actually came up recently a little bit on the forums. Anyway, but this seems to suggest a view that I actually find some value to, and that is that the brain in some way accesses memories of the mind, you know, like it can, it acts as a tool to access memories which are actually stored in the mind. Well, I guess they're not necessarily saying that. Maybe they're saying that the memories are stored in the brain. But then, you know, how would these people remember who they are once they go into another body, you know, if they leave their memories behind and can't access them anymore? So it seems to me this would support the idea that memories are part of the mind, but the physical brain is able to and is used to access them, which is why once they've switched into each other's bodies, they are able to, in some limited capacity, access each other's memories and kind of appreciate their background and their perspective more. And no doubt this kind of episode, you know, it's going to allow them to understand each other. It's kind of an unintentional bonding episode. They get to understand each other just a little bit more, similar to how Aaron and Pilot bonded as a result of her having Pilot's DNA fused with hers. So anyway, that's interesting tidbit, interesting just a little point of relevance. Man, if Star Trek had an episode like this, they would never, never have a man in a woman's body and then start scoping themselves out in their private moments. That's just kind of an example of the subversive nature of Farscape, you know. And I mean, I like the way they handled it because it was you know, material of a sexual nature, of a sexual theme, but it wasn't done in a way, I don't think, that was like that was designed to be like titillating, that was designed to arouse the audience, you know. If anything, it made me very uncomfortable. and then just laugh and just like, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, it was just kind of a horribly great moment in the episode. Oh my gosh, so many laugh out loud moments, like when the Skeksis guy comes on board and he starts puking. It's just like, yeah, well, there you go. It's not Farscape until somebody starts puking. And he's like, oh, excuse me. And Rigel in Crichton's body is like, oh, there's no problem. We do that sort of thing all the time here on Moya. You know, he says, I just peed in the maintenance bay. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Love this episode. Oh, my gosh. And that was so, that was, speaking of awkward sexually themed moments, oh my gosh, Dargo and Crichton in the corridor. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, that was almost too much. Yeah. Yep, subversive episode, great episode. Nothing more I got to say on this one. Next time, episode, if I'm not mistaken, 210, which is not one of my favorite episodes in terms of the story. It's kind of Far Trek-y. But thematically and philosophically, I think there is some interesting things being said about the evolutionary viewpoint and what kind of philosophy naturally flows out of that, what kind of morality naturally flows out of that, that really was not being said. It's more common now to acknowledge this about naturalistic evolution and what philosophy naturally, what morality naturally comes out of that. And so I think Farscape was kind of a front runner. But anyway, we're going to talk about My Three Crichtons next time.